A dangerous mythology had been constructed around the idea that though we weren't the only ones to recognize problems, we were an essential part of solving them. The truth, though, was that just as other people often recognized problems before we did because they were closer to them, they in turn raised the issues with us and helped us solve them. Our decreased presence in the office was a chance for Pixar's people to see what I already knew, that other leaders at the company had answers to. Still, despite the protections we'd put in place, it took a while for the people of Pixar to trust that no one was coming over the hill to change us or that we were abandoning them. Eventually, though, the feeling we had hoped would emerge within Pixar, a sense of strong local ownership combined with a pride in what Disney, the parent company, had accomplished as well, led to a healthier relationship with Disney as a whole. The takeaway from managers is that this didn't happen by accident. This corporate détente, if you will, wouldn't have been possible, I think, without the 5-year compact. The document, while providing great comfort to Pixar employees, prompted several complaints from the Disney Studios Human Resources Department. The complaints boiled down to the fact that they didn't care for the exceptionalism that our carefully guarded policies implied. My response to this stemmed less from a loyalty to Pixar than from my commitment to a larger idea. In big organizations, there are advantages to consistency, but I strongly believe that smaller groups within the larger whole should be allowed to differentiate themselves and operate according to their own rules so long as those rules work. This fosters a sense of personal ownership and pride in the company that, to my mind, benefits the larger enterprise. In a merger of this scope, there are seemingly countless calls to make every day on issues big and small. One of the biggest decisions John and I made at Disney was actually to reverse a decision made in 2004 to shut down the studio's hand-drawn animation efforts. The rise of computer animation, and 3D in particular, had convinced Disney's previous leaders that the era of hand-drawn animation was over. Watching from afar, John and I thought this was tragic. We felt the decline of hand-drawn animation was not attributable to the appeal of 3D, but simply to lackluster storytelling. We wanted Disney Animation to return to what had made them great. So when we heard that our predecessors had opted not to renew the contracts of one of the studio's leading directing duos, John Musker and Ron Clements, whose credits included the hand-drawn classics The Little Mermaid and Aladdin, this particular call seemed like a no-brainer. As quickly as we could, we brought John and Ron back and told them to start pitching new ideas. Right off, they proposed a twist on a classic fairy tale, The Frog Prince, which would take place in New Orleans and feature as its heroine Disney's first-ever African-American princess. We greenlighted The Princess and the Frog and began reassembling a crew that had been dispersed to the winds. We asked our team at Disney to propose 3 scenarios for rebuilding the hand-drawn production effort. Their first was to reestablish the old system exactly as it existed before we arrived, which we rejected as too expensive. The second scenario was to farm out the production work, subcontracting it to cheaper animation houses overseas, which we rejected for fear that it would diminish the film's quality. The third scenario, however, felt just right. A combination of hiring key talent inside the studio while outsourcing certain parts of the process that wouldn't affect quality. The number of staffers we need to make this happen, I was told, was 192, to which I replied, "Done." But they couldn't go over that number. John and I were excited. Not only were we reviving the art form that the studio was built upon, this was the first movie at Disney that would be made start to finish on our watch. We could feel the energy in the building. It was as if everyone working on The Princess and the Frog felt that they had something to prove. We set about giving them some of the tools we used at Pixar and teaching them how to use them. Research trips, for example. We talked our heads off about the value of research while hammering out the storyline of a new film. Frankly, it took a while to get the Disney folks on board with this idea. They seemed to want to lock down the story quickly so they could start making the movie, and they didn't see at first how research would help them. They saw it as a distraction. It's like a math problem where they say, "Show your work," says Byron Howard, expressing how people at Disney Animation initially viewed John's insistence that people leave the building as they conceived their stories. John expects that if you have sketched out buildings from your movie, it isn't just bullshit you're throwing up on the screen. The same with characters, costumes, story. John really believes that genuineness comes through in every detail. We persisted. This was something we knew was an essential component of creativity, and we weren't kidding about its importance. So during the prepping of The Princess and the Frog, the entire creative leadership of the film headed to Louisiana. Attending the crew of Bacchus Parade on the Sunday before Mardi Gras gave them a vivid frame of reference when they animated a sequence based on that festival. Their ride on the riverboat Natchez helped them block out a scene set on a similar river-going vessel. A tour of the St. Charles Avenue streetcar line ensured that they captured the distinct clang of the trolley's bell and the sounds and the colors. All of it was right there in front of them. Upon their return, the directors, Ron and John, each told me that research inspired the production in ways they never expected. It was the beginning of a sea change. Today, directors and writers at Disney can't imagine developing an idea for a film without doing research. Leading up to the release of The Princess and the Frog, we'd had many conversations about what to call it. For a while, we considered the title The Frog Princess, but Disney's marketing folks warned us. Having the word princess in the title would lead moviegoers to think that the film was for girls only. We pushed back, believing that the quality of the film would trump that association and lure viewers of all ages, male and female. We felt a return to hand-drawn animation, done in the service of a beloved fairy tale, would pack 'em in. Turns out, it was our own version of a stupid pill. When The Princess and the Frog was released, we believed we had made a good film, the reviews confirmed that belief, and people who saw it loved it. However, we would soon learn that we had made a serious mistake, one that was only compounded by the fact that our movie opened nationwide just 5 days before James Cameron's science fiction fantasy, Avatar. This scheduling only encouraged moviegoers to take one look at a film with the word princess in the title and think, that's for little girls only. To say that we are making a great film but not listen to the input of experienced colleagues within the company imperiled the quality we were so proud of. Quality meant that every aspect, not just the rendering and the storytelling, but also the positioning and the marketing, needed to be done well, which meant being open to reasoned opinions, even when they contradicted our own. The movie had come in under budget, which is the rarest of achievements in the entertainment business. The quality of its animation rivaled the best ever done by the studio. The film was profitable as we'd kept costs down, but it just didn't make enough to convince anyone at the studio that we should pour more resources into hand-drawn films. While we'd had high hopes that the film would prove that 2D could rise again, our narrow vision and poor decision-making made it seem like the opposite was true. While we thought then, and still think today, that hand-drawn animation is a wonderfully expressive medium, I realize now that I got carried away by my childhood memories of the Disney animation I'd once so enjoyed. I'd liked the idea of celebrating right out of the box the art form that Walt Disney himself pioneered. After The Princess and the Frog's somewhat lackluster opening, I knew we had to rethink what we were doing. Around that time, Andrew Milstein pulled me aside and pointed out that our double-barreled approach, reviving 2D while also championing 3D, was confusing the people within the studio we fundamentally wanted to encourage to focus on the future. The issue with 2D was not the validity of the time-honored art form, but that Disney's directors needed and wanted to engage with the new. In the aftermath of the merger, many people had asked me whether we were going to have Disney do 2D and Pixar 3D. They were expecting Disney to do the old stuff and Pixar to do the new. In the wake of The Princess and the Frog, I realized how important it was to nip this toxic way of thinking in the bud. The truth was, Disney's directors respected the studio's heritage, but they wanted to build on it. And in order to do that, they had to be free to forge their own path. Disney Animation's embrace of the new would take on steam, ironically, when it finally figured out how to reframe and rethink something old, the fairy tale Rapunzel. This was a project that had languished for years in development hell, kicking around Disney, enduring a few false starts, and finally being left for dead. But now the studio was becoming creatively healthier, and people were talking to one another. John often said that the problem at Disney Animation was never lack of talent. It was that years of stifling working conditions had made people lose their creative compasses. Now, even with the box office disappointment of The Princess and the Frog, they were dusting those compasses off again. For years, many at Disney had tried, and failed, to crack the story of Rapunzel, she of the famous mane of hair, in a way that seemed destined to make a terrific movie. The central challenge was that a girl locked in a tower is hardly an active scenario for a feature film. At one point, Michael Eisner himself had proposed updating the tale, calling it Rapunzel Unbraided, and setting it in modern-day San Francisco. Then, somehow, our heroine would be transported into the fairy tale world. The director of the film, Glenn Keane, one of the greatest animators ever, known for his work on The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and Beauty and the Beast, couldn't make this idea work, which left the project at an impasse. The week before John and I arrived, our predecessors shut the project down. One of our first acts at Disney was to ask Glenn to keep Rapunzel going. It was a classic story, we reasoned, perfect for the Disney brand. Surely there was a way to make it work as a film? Right around then, Glenn had a temporary health scare and was forced to reduce his role in the film to that of an advisor. In October 2008, we brought on directors Byron Howard and Nathan Greeno, who were both fresh off their success with Bolt. Howard had directed it with Chris Williams. Greeno had been head of story. They took the story in a different direction, teaming up with the writer Dan Fogelman and the composer Alan Menken, who had done the music for the iconic Disney musicals of the 1990s. This Rapunzel was more assertive than the character in the classic tale, and her hair had magical healing powers, which she could activate by singing an incantation. This version of the story was familiar, but sassy and modern at the same time. Determined not to repeat the mistake we'd made with The Princess and the Frog, we changed the movie's title from Rapunzel to the more gender-neutral Tangled. Internally, the decision was controversial, as some people felt we were letting marketing concerns dictate creative decisions, that we were bastardizing a classic property. Nathan and Byron rebutted that charge, saying that because their story focused on a female and a male character, a former thief named Flynn Rider, Tangled better captured the fact that the movie was about a duo. You wouldn't call Toy Story Buzz Lightyear, as Nathan said. Released in November 2010, Tangled was a runaway success, artistically and commercially. A.O. Scott of the New York Times wrote, "Its look and spirit convey a modified, updated, but nonetheless sincere and unmistakable quality of old-fashioned Disneyness." The movie went on to earn more than $590 million worldwide, becoming the second highest-grossing film from Disney Animation ever after The Lion King. The studio had its first number one hit in 16 years, and the reverberations within the building were palpable. I could stop there, but there is a coda to this story that will resonate with any manager in any business. It involved John's and my determination to use the success of Tangled as a healing moment for the studio, and we felt like we knew just how to do it. We had learned long ago that while everyone appreciates cash bonuses, they value something else almost as much, being looked in the eye by someone they respect and told, "Thank you." At Pixar, we'd devised a way to give our employees money and gratitude. When a movie makes enough money to trigger bonuses, John and I join with the directors and producers and personally distribute checks to every person who worked on the film. This jibes with our belief that each film belongs to everyone at the studio and is related to our "ideas can come from anywhere" credo. Everyone is encouraged to give notes and pitch in, and they do. The distribution of bonuses one by one can take a while, but we feel it's essential to take the time to shake each person's hand and tell them how much their contribution mattered. In the wake of Tangled's success, I asked Anne LeCam, our Vice President of Human Resources, to help us do something along the same lines at Disney. She printed up personalized letters for each crew member explaining the reason for the bonus, and on a weekday morning in the spring of 2010, Disney Animation's general manager Andrew Milstein, the directors Nathan Greenough and Byron Howard, the previous director and inspiration for the movie Glenn Keane, the producer Roy Conley, and John and I asked everyone who'd worked on Tangled to gather in one of the large stages at Disney. As they milled about, they didn't know what was coming. We'd suggested to them that it was a general meeting. But when they saw the envelopes in our hands, they knew something was up. It was Anne's idea to give each crew member a hot-off-the-presses DVD of the movie as well, a small gesture that made our gratitude feel even more genuine. To this day, some Tangled veterans still display framed copies of the letter they received that day on their office walls. Would it have been easier simply to wire bonuses into employees' direct deposit accounts? Yes. But like I always say when talking about making a movie, easy isn't the goal. Quality is the goal. The ship was beginning to turn, and it would only keep turning. I mentioned before that Disney's Story Trust has evolved into a strong, supportive group. But in our first years there, it lacked leaders who excelled at storytelling structure. Even though the group was very good, I wasn't sure if any of its members would grow into the kind of facilitators that had emerged at Pixar. This worried me, because I knew how heavily Pixar relied on Andrew Stanton and Brad Bird's ability to chart the beats of a story and to make things better. But all we could do at Disney, I knew, was create a healthy creative environment and see what developed. I was enormously gratified then, as the studio was making Wreck-It Ralph and Frozen, directed by Chris Buck and Jennifer Lee, who also wrote the script, when I noticed something changing from within. The writers at the studio had bonded with each other and, as a group, had begun to play a key role in the Story Trust meetings, especially when it came to structuring the films. This feedback group had become as good as Pixar's Brain Trust, but with its own personality. It was an indication of something larger that was happening. The studio as a whole was operating more smoothly, and I want to emphasize that it was still populated by most of the same people John and I had first encountered when we arrived. We had applied our principles to a dysfunctional group and had changed them, unleashing their creative potential. They had become a cohesive team, stocked with standout talents. This brought Disney Animation to a new level. Now we had a creative roster that was as good as the one at Pixar, yet quite different. The studio Walt Disney had built had become worthy of him once again. Chapter 13. Notes Day. When I began this book, I hoped to capture some of the thinking that underlies the way we work at Pixar and Disney Animation. I also hoped that by talking with my colleagues, bouncing my theories off of them, and reflecting on what we had built, I would clarify my own beliefs about creativity and how it is grown, protected, and sustained. 2 years later, I feel like I've managed to do these things, but the clarity didn't come easy. In part, that's because while I was writing this book, I was also working full-time at Disney and Pixar, and the world did not stand still. Partly, too, clarity was elusive because I don't believe in simple prescriptive formulas for success. I wanted this book to acknowledge the complexity that creativity requires, and that meant wading into some murky areas. During the period that I worked on this book, Disney continued to evolve rather dramatically, with its story trust becoming a candid and supportive feedback system, and its production group reaching new levels of technical and storytelling sophistication. Each of Disney's films had setbacks, which we expected, but we found ways to work our way through them. Frozen opened on the day before Thanksgiving 2013, and, like Tangled, became a worldwide box office success, a victory made even sweeter because it came on the heels of the studio's 2012 triumph, Wreck-It Ralph. The creative culture at Disney Animation, I believe, is fundamentally different than when John and I arrived in 2006. As all this was taking place, Pixar released Monsters University, which you may remember underwent a change of directors during its journey to the multiplex. The film, our 14th number one movie in a row, grossed $82 million on its opening weekend, making it the second biggest Pixar opening ever, and went on to make more than $740 million worldwide. The mood inside Pixar was jubilant. But, as always, my focus was on the challenges ahead and on staying true to our goal of recognizing problems early and engaging them fully. I have noted that there are forces at work in any company that are hard to see. At Pixar, those forces, among them the impact of growth and the reverberations of success, had sparked several problems. For example, as we'd grown, we had taken in quite a mixture of people. So in addition to the colleagues who had been with us from the beginning and who understood the principles that guided the company since they'd lived through the events that had forged these principles, we now had more recent arrivals. While some of these people learned quickly, absorbing the ideas that made our company work and becoming new leaders, others were in awe of the place, respectful of our history to the point that they could be hindered by it. Many brought good new ideas with them, but some were reluctant to suggest them. After all, this was the great and mighty Pixar, they thought. Who were they to call for change? Some were grateful for the supportive environment, the subsidized cafeteria, the top-of-the-line tools, but others took them for granted, figuring that such perks came with the territory. There were many who loved how successful we'd been, but some didn't understand the struggle and risk that success had entailed. Why couldn't we just make things simpler, these people wanted to know. In short, Pixar had the kind of diverse problems that any successful company has, but chief among them, to my mind, was that more and more people had begun to feel that it was either not safe or not welcome to offer differing ideas. This hesitancy was difficult to see at first, but when we paid attention, we saw many clues that people were holding back. To me, that meant one thing. We, as leaders, were allowing some faulty ideas to take hold, and that was bad for our culture. There is nothing like a crisis, though, to bring what ails a company to the surface. And now, we had three crises brewing at once. One, our production costs were rising and we needed to rein them in. Two, external economic forces were putting pressure on our business. And three, one of the central tenets of our culture. Good ideas can come from anywhere, so everyone must feel empowered to speak up, was faltering. Too many of our people, and to my mind, too many is the same as any, were self-censoring. That needed to change. These three challenges, and our belief that there was no single big idea that would solve them, led us to try something that we hoped would break the logjam and reinvigorate the studio. We called it Notes Day, and I see it as a stellar example of how to set the table for creativity. Managers of creative companies must never forget to ask themselves, how do we tap the brain power of our people? From its genesis to its execution, from the goodwill it engendered to the company-wide changes it set in motion, Notes Day was a success in part because it was based on the idea that fixing things is an ongoing, incremental process. Creative people must accept that challenges never cease, failure can't be avoided, and vision is often an illusion. But they must also feel safe, always, to speak their minds. Notes Day was a reminder that collaboration, determination, and candor never fail to lift us up. I am often asked which Pixar movie makes me the proudest. My answer is that while I take pride in all our movies, what makes me most proud is how our people respond to crisis. When we have a problem, the leaders of the company don't say, "What the hell are you guys going to do about it?" Instead, there is talk of our problem and of what we can do to solve it together. My colleagues see themselves as part owners of the company and of the culture because they are. They are very protective of Pixar. And it was this protective and participatory spirit that led to Notes Day. In January 2013, Pixar's leadership, about 35 of us, including our producers and directors, gathered for a two-day offsite at Cavallo Point, a former Army base turned conference center in Sausalito, just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. On the agenda were two pressing issues. The first was the rising cost of making our films. The second was an unfortunate shift in the culture that all of Pixar's leaders had noticed. As Pixar had grown, it had changed. No surprise there, change happens, and a 1,200-person company, Pixar Now, is going to operate differently than one that employs 45, Pixar then. But many of us were concerned that with that growth had come an erosion of some of the principles that had made us successful in the past. The situation wasn't dire, far from it, in fact, as we had several very exciting projects in the works. But as we gathered at Cavallo Point, there was an urgency in the room. Each of the 35 men and women there was engaged by the desire to keep Pixar on the right track. Tom Porter, our head of production, who also happens to be a pioneer in computer graphics and one of the founders of Pixar, led off the day with an extended analysis of our costs. Distribution methods were changing rapidly, he noted, and so too were the economics of our business. That we were doing well as a company didn't make us immune to these greater forces, And we all agreed that we needed to stay ahead of trouble by keeping our costs down. At the same time, we did not want to stop taking risks. We wanted always to be a company that would gamble on unusual films such as Up, Ratatouille, and WALL-E. Not every film had to tackle unconventional stories, of course, but we wanted every filmmaker to feel free to propose them. These two issues were interconnected. When costs are low, it's easier to justify taking a risk. Thus, unless we lowered our costs, we could effectively limit the kinds of films that we would be able to make. Moreover, there was another benefit of lowering costs. Cheaper films are made with smaller crews, and everyone agrees that the smaller the crew, the better the working experience. It's not just that a leaner crew is closer and more collegial. It's that on a smaller production, it's easier for people to feel that they've made an impact. Our first film, Toy Story, was made with our smallest crew. But as each successive film became more visually complex, the headcount started to creep up. At the time of the offsite at Cavallo Point, making a Pixar film required, on average, about 22,000 person weeks, the unit of measurement we commonly use in our budget. We needed to reduce that number by about 10%. But we needed something else as well, something that was harder to quantify. Increasingly, we sensed that our people, having enjoyed years of success, were under a great deal of pressure not to fail. Nobody wanted to have worked on the first movie that didn't open at number one, and the result was a growing temptation to pour too much visual detail into each film, to make it perfect. That honorable-sounding desire, we call it plussing, was accompanied by a kind of paralyzing anxiety. What if we couldn't achieve the expected level of excellence? What if we couldn't break new ground visually? As a company, our determination to avoid disappointments was also causing us to shy away from risk. The specter of past excellence was sapping us of some of the energy that we'd once used to pursue excellence. In addition to this, many new people had come into the company, people who had not experienced the ups and downs of our previous films. Thus, they had preconceived notions of what it was like to work at a successful company. As at many companies, one of the consequences of wild success is the pernicious distortion of reality. Increasingly, we would hear that people had opinions about things they thought were wrong, but were unwilling to express them. One of our greatest values, that solutions could come from anyone and that everyone should feel free to weigh in, was slowly being subverted under our watchful eyes, and only we could correct it. "Sometimes I think people have gotten too comfortable," John said when we gathered in a renovated chapel on the resort grounds. "They need to feel excited, to feel like we once did, on fire and buzzing with possibility." This wasn't the first time John and I had wondered about how Pixar's people were affected by being at the front of the pack for so long. Would they gradually begin to take success for granted? "There's a lightness and a speed at Disney that I want to see more of at Pixar," John said. How, we all wondered, could we maintain Pixar's sense of intensity and playfulness, beating back the creeping conservatism that often accompanies success, while also getting leaner and more nimble? That's when Guido Quaroni spoke up. Guido is vice president of our tools department, and he spends a lot of time thinking about how to keep his 120 engineers happy. His challenge on that front is real. His department develops technology, but Pixar doesn't sell technology. It sells stories enabled by technology, which means that when a Pixar engineer develops a piece of software, it is deemed successful only in so much as it helps our movies get made. "I've talked about the problem at Pixar of people questioning how much of each movie's success can be attributed to them personally. For engineers, that uncertainty can be particularly acute. Guido knows that if he's not careful, that disconnect can lead to low morale. So to retain the best engineers, he works extra hard to make sure they enjoy their jobs. When Guido had the floor, he told a story about something he'd instituted in his department called Personal Project Days. 2 days a month, he allowed his engineers to work on anything they wanted, using Pixar's resources to engage with whatever problem or question they found interesting. It didn't have to be directly applicable to any particular film or address any of production's needs. If an engineer wanted to see what it was like to light a shot in Brave, for example, he or she could. If a group of engineers wanted to build a prototype using Kinect, Microsoft's motion sensing input device, to help animators capture characters' movements, they could do that too. Any idea that sparked their curiosity, they were free to pursue. You just give people the time, and they come up with the ideas, Guido told us. That's the beauty of it. It comes from them. Guido had already told me about how, in just 4 months, Personal Project Days had re-energized his staff. Privately, we'd even begun to brainstorm ideas about how similar efforts could be implemented company-wide. At one point, he'd suggested shutting down Pixar for a week at the end of a movie's production cycle to talk about what went right, what went wrong, and how to reboot for the next project, a sort of super post-mortem. The idea wasn't practical in the end, but it was thought-provoking. Now, as we contemplated how to achieve our goal of cutting costs by 10%, Guido had a simple suggestion. Let's ask Pixar's people, all of them, for ideas about how to do it, he said. Looking at John, I could see his gears begin turning. Okay, now that's interesting, he said. What if we closed Pixar for the day? Everybody will come to work, but all we'll talk about is how to solve this problem. We dedicate an entire day to it. The room was instantly abuzz. This is so Pixar, Andrew said. Totally unexpected. Yes, you want people to get excited? That's going to do it. When I asked who in the room would be willing to help organize it, everyone's hands shot up. I believe that no creative company should ever stop evolving, and this would be our latest attempt to avoid stagnation. We wanted to explore issues big and small, to give candid notes to ourselves about the workings of the company, much like we would give notes on a movie in a brain trust meeting. So it made sense, as we began to make Guido's idea a reality, to invoke our shorthand term for candid feedback. Notes. At some point, we decided that Monday, March 11th, 2013, would be called Notes Day. The exercise would be fruitless without the buy-in of our people, so we scheduled 3 town hall-style meetings to explain the idea to more than 300 employees at a time. Tom Porter presented an abbreviated version of his off-site talk to set up the problem, and then John and I laid out the plan. It'll be a day in which you tell us how to make Pixar better, John said. We'll do no work that day. No visitors will be allowed. Everyone must attend. We have a problem, I said, and we believe the only people who know what to do about it are you. We appointed Tom to preside over Notes Day and make sure that it was more than merely a feel-good exercise. From the start, he made clear what Notes Day was and wasn't. This is not a call for working faster or doing more overtime or making do with fewer people, he said in one town hall forum. This is about making 3 films every 2 years with roughly the same number of people we've got today. We hope to rely on improvements in technology. We hope that productions can share resources and avoid reinventing the wheel each time. We hope that artists can benefit from greater clarity from the directors. But to make good on these hopes and to realize other areas in which we could improve, Pixar's leaders needed everyone to speak up. Tom got together with Guido, Laurie McAdams, the Vice President of Human Resources, and producers Catherine Serafian and Galen Sussman to form the core of the Notes Day Working Group. That group would soon expand, drafting dozens of volunteers for specific assignments. First, it created an electronic suggestion box where Pixar people could submit discussion topics they thought would help us become more innovative and more efficient. Immediately, topic ideas began flooding in, along with suggestions about how to run Notes Day itself. The suggestion box, in turn, prompted something that none of us had expected. Many departments, without any prodding, created their own wiki pages and blogs to hash out what they believed the core issues at Pixar really were. Weeks before Notes Day, people were talking among themselves in ways they hadn't before about how, specifically, to improve workflow and enact positive change. When people asked for guidance on how to be involved, Tom nudged them along, sending this hypothetical prompt to anyone who asked. The year is 2017. Both of this year's films were completed in well under 18,500 person weeks. What innovations helped these productions meet their budget goals? What are some specific things that we did differently? In the end, 4,000 emails poured into the Notes Day suggestion box, containing 1,000 separate ideas in all. As Tom and his team read and evaluated them, they were careful not to dismiss the unexpected. While we discarded the ones that felt like general grumbling, we also made room for interesting ideas that might, but might not, lead somewhere, he told me. I am sure we were biased toward ideas that would clearly help us get to 18,500 person weeks, but there were many topics we picked with only a loose or non-obvious connection to that goal. I'd say our major criterion was, can you imagine 20 people talking about this topic for an hour? Putting like with like, Tom's team distilled the 1,000 ideas down to 293 discussion topics. That was still way too many for a single day's agenda, so a group of senior managers then met and whittled down those 120 topics, organized into several broad categories such as training, environment, and culture, cross-show resource pooling, we often call our movies shows, tools and technology, and workflow. The winnowing process was difficult, and it was made even more so by the diversity of the questions posed. Some were valid but highly technical in nature, such as, out-of-memory errors related to inadequately pruned sets consume a significant amount of computer and human time. What can be done to improve pruning? Others were more sociological, as in, how can we return to a good ideas come from anywhere culture? And then there was my favorite. How can we get to a 12,000-person-week movie? That's right, 12,000. This was a discussion topic prompted by emails from several people whose reaction to the call for a 10% budget cut was, naturally, to ask whether a more drastic cut might be possible as well. 18-5, smateen-5, said the header on one email received by the Notes Day Working Group. What, this writer asked, if of the 3 films Pixar made every 2 years, one of them was produced for a reduced scope of 15,000 person weeks or even 12,500? No skimping on story, just simplifying the rest. Another person emailed, I, for one, would like to work on a 10,000 person week film. I feel that the measures you designed to enable it would inform efforts to make the 18,500-person-week film. Still another asked, What kind of film would Pixar make with 12,000 person weeks? Is there a creative idea that could live up to our reputation, but be done for that little? Where would the cuts be? What would be different about the process? The subject line for that email, by the way, was, "Get Radical." Once the whittling process was complete, Tom needed to find out roughly how many people were interested in each discussion topic so that he could plan the day accordingly. To that end, the Notes Day working group circulated a survey, and what he learned was striking. The number one topic, the one that the most people wanted to talk about, was how to achieve a 12,000-person-week movie. In the end, Tom and his team would arrange 7 separate 90-minute sessions on this topic alone. The people who signed up for these sessions weren't martyrs. The problem of doing more with less was interesting to them, and they wanted to engage with it. Think about that. The topic that captured my Pixar colleagues' imagination more than any other was an attempt to be even more aggressive in trying to reduce the budget. They truly understood the problem and its implications. Can you see why I have so much pride in this place? The nitty-gritty of how all this was organized may seem a bit micro to describe here, but it couldn't have been more vital to the way the day played out. It's all well and good to gather people to discuss workplace challenges, but it was extremely important that we find a way to turn all that talk into something tangible, usable, valuable. How the day was designed, we felt, would be the deciding factor in accomplishing that. Tom and his team decided early on that people would determine their own schedules, signing up for only the sessions that interested them. Each of the Notes Day discussion groups would be led by a facilitator recruited from among the company's production managers. The week before Notes Day, all facilitators attended a training session to help them keep each meeting on track and make sure that everyone, the outgoing, the laid-back, and everyone in between, was heard from. Then, to make sure something concrete emerged, the working group designed a set of exit forms to be filled out by each session's participants. Red forms were for proposals, blue forms were for brainstorms, and yellow forms were for something we called best practices, ideas that were not action items per se, but principles about how we should behave as a company. The forms were simple and specific. Each session got its own set, tailored specifically to the topic at hand, that asked a specific question. For example, the session called Returning to a Good Ideas Come From Anywhere Culture had blue exit forms topped with this header. Imagine it's 2017. We've broken down barriers so that people feel safe to speak up. Senior employees are open to new processes. What did we do to achieve this success? Underneath that question were boxes in which attendees could pencil in 3 answers. Then, after they wrote a general description of each idea, they were asked to go a few steps further. What benefits to Pixar would these ideas bring, and what should be the next steps to make them a reality? Finally, there was space provided to specify who is the best audience for this idea and who should pitch this idea. The goal was meaningful engagement that would lead to action. And while Tom and his team had made room for a variety of topics, there was a consistency to the way they were framed. A best practices session called Lessons from the Outside had a yellow exit form that posed the question, "What can we learn from best practices at other companies?" Underneath, it had space for 3 lessons, each with the same benefits to Pixar next steps follow-up. The red exit form for a proposal session called Helping Directors Understand Costs in Story gave the session's attendees a jumping-off point. Introduce the concept of cost early in the story process. Build in scope discussions in the idea generation phase. Story plays a role in the budget process when building reels. Then, in a space marked revised proposal, this form encouraged participants to improve on the stated approach. How does this benefit the studio, the form asked, and what are the drawbacks? At the bottom was another question. Is this idea worth pursuing? With two boxes underneath. Yes, and next steps, or no, because. The yes option asked, who's the best audience for this proposal? Be specific. And again, there was this, who should pitch this proposal? I think you're getting a sense of how hard our team worked to make sure Notes Day took us where we needed to go. As Tom put it, we didn't just want to make lists of cool things we could do. The goal was to identify passionate people who would take ideas forward. We wanted to put people with clever insights in front of Pixar's executive team. On the Friday before Notes Day, I got an email telling me that 1,059 people had signed up, nearly everyone in the company, given that some employees were on leave or away. The following Monday, we would discuss 106 topics in 171 sessions managed by 138 facilitators in 66 meeting spaces across our three buildings, from offices to conference rooms to common spaces like the Poodle Lounge, which has a painting of George Washington on the wall, a beanbag toss game on the floor, and a disco ball hanging overhead. We were as ready as we were ever going to be to let this experiment unfold. At 9 a.m. on March 11th, everyone gathered in the atrium of the Steve Jobs building. If the navy blue Pixar sweatshirt I was wearing didn't make it obvious enough, the look on my face gave it away. I was enormously proud of how our people had already shown their commitment to making Notes Day a historic day for us. I told them as much as I welcomed them, and then I handed the mic to John. John often plays the role of inspirer in chief, and the people at Disney and Pixar alike rely on his energy and optimism. But this was no rah-rah call to action. Ambling to the front of the stage, John proceeded to deliver the most heartfelt and emotional speech I had ever heard him give. He started by talking about candor and how we spend a lot of time at Pixar talking about its importance. But candor is hard, both to deliver and to receive. He knew this firsthand, he said, because in preparation for Notes Day, the organizers had shared something else that had come into the electronic suggestion box. A fair amount of feedback had focused on John himself, and not all of it was positive. In particular, people were upset that because he was now splitting his time between two studios, they were seeing less of him. The bottom line was that they missed him. But they also felt that there were ways that John could better handle the inordinate pressure he was under. John admitted that this hurt. Still, he wanted to hear all of the specific criticisms. So they prepared a list, he said. Instead, I got 2.5 pages. Among the things he learned, John was so tightly scheduled and meetings with him were so precious that people tended to over-prepare to see him, which served no one. In fact, John said, there were a lot of notes about my time management and how I carry the emotion of one meeting into the next, making some people ask, why is he upset at us? I didn't know I was doing any of this, and those 2.5 pages were really tough to read. But it was so valuable for me to hear, and I'm already working to correct those things. The atrium was quiet, despite the crowd. So today, please be honest, John continued. And those of you in management positions, be aware that some of this is going to feel like it's directed at you personally. I'm not kidding. It's going to happen. But put your tough skin on and for the sake of Pixar, speak up and don't stop the honesty. Trust me, that's what today is about. It's about making Pixar better forever, for all of you and for the next generations of Pixarians. This is going to fundamentally change the company for the better, but it starts with you. It was time to go to class. For the first hour of Notes Day, everyone at the company headed to their own departmental meeting, story, lighting, shading, accounting, what have you, where they shared ideas with their closest colleagues about how to be more efficient. These departmental meetings, we felt, would serve as a sort of warm-up for the day. It's always easier to be candid with people you know than with strangers. But as John had urged, Pixar's people needed to put their thickest skins and bravest faces on. Because beginning at 10:45 a.m., when everybody headed to their first session, chances were good that for the rest of the day, no Pixar employee was going to find him or herself sitting next to any of the people they knew best. Why? Because the sessions weren't organized by job or by department. They were organized by individual interest. During the lead-up to Notes Day, each person had been asked what they wanted to discuss, and Tom's team had created enough sessions to accommodate everyone. While some topics were so specialized that interest was limited to a narrow subset of employees, for example, to take just one, what range of solutions do we have for improving lighting productivity? Curiosity being what it is, many topics attracted all kinds of people from across the company. If you showed up, for instance, to a brainstorming session called Developing and Appreciating a Great Workplace, it's 2017. Nobody at the studio behaves as if they are entitled. How did we accomplish that? You would have found Pixar's executive chef, a woman who worked in legal, a woman from finance, a veteran animator, a man from systems, and more than a dozen others. What had attracted such a cross-section? For that particular session, everyone said they picked it because of the word entitled in the descriptor. They'd all encountered people who acted entitled at Pixar. People who insisted on having their own piece of equipment, even if it could be shared, or who groused that they couldn't bring their dogs to work. This is a job, one animator said. A great job. We are well paid. These people need to wake up. What was most striking to those in attendance at the Great Workplace session was how much they had in common. The systems guy told a story about answering a frantic call for tech support. He rushed over to assess the problem, only to be told by the aggrieved artist that the machine should be fixed during lunch, because that's when it would be most convenient for her. I need to eat lunch, too, he told the group as everyone nodded their heads. The chef told a similar story about a last-minute request to cater a working lunch that came without any acknowledgement of the hassle and hustle it would require of her staff. A character animator lamented that he didn't know more about what people in other departments, like lighting and shading, did. It makes it easy to vilify and resent each other, he said. One by one, the people in this session hit on the same themes. We need to make people behave more like peers, one person said. I wish more people knew about the whole production pipeline, by which I mean that they appreciated and understood what other people do, said another. We need to heighten people's awareness of what they do not know. Among the ideas this group put on their exit forms, fostering more empathy between departments through a job-swapping program, establishing a lunch lottery that would match people at random to encourage new connections and friendships, and holding cross-departmental mixers designed to let far-flung colleagues get to know each other over a few beers. I chose to describe that session in part because it's broadly relatable. No matter what business you're in, you've run across the scourge of entitlement, Were I to describe some other Notes Days sessions, one on centralized rendering, say, I think I'd risk losing a few people. But regardless of the topic that was being discussed, no matter where you were on campus, you could feel a frisson of energy. If you stepped into a Pixar restroom or stepped outside for some air, you couldn't avoid overhearing people chatting about how exciting Notes Day was. The feeling was that we were engaged in something that would make a difference. Midway through the day, Tom gathered the facilitators to check briefly how things were going and to encourage them to share their experiences thus far. At one point, he asked, "How many of you had suggestions in your sessions that could be implemented immediately?" Everybody raised their hands. We'd made a decision to separate out Pixar's executives, directors, and producers from the Notes Day sessions. Partly, this was because it was vital that people speak freely, and we weren't sure they would if we were there. Partly, too, we peeled off because there were particular topics that we needed to consider among ourselves. Creative oversight. Our brain trust sessions as useful as they were 10 years ago. Leadership tone and temperament. How can we better foster a culture of inclusiveness in which anyone can suggest a labor-saving idea? The need to spend money where it can do the most good. We have a system that is vulnerable to excess that rewards perfectionists and pleasers. How do we manage perfectionism and the desire to innovate? I knew things were going well from the looks on our colleagues' faces as they hurried from session to session. They were beaming. At day's end, as the entire company gathered outside for beer, hot dogs, and some instant analysis, I noticed people from different departments continuing the discussions they'd begun inside. The energy on the whole campus was electric. This was the Pixar that they wanted, that we wanted. I made a point of stopping by several bulletin boards we'd erected to encourage people to share their impressions. Among those posted under a variety of categories were Favorite Moment from Notes Day, John Lasseter's Candor, Something New I Learned Today, People Care, People Can Change, How Many New People Did You Meet Today? 23. And then there was this, Notes Day is the proof that Pixar cares about people as much as about finances, and Do This Again Next Year. The next morning, I received emails from hundreds of employees. One from a storyboard artist perfectly captured the feeling expressed by many. "Hello, Ed," it read. "I just wanted to say a post-Notes Day thank you. The day was truly amazing, inspirational, informative, and as I heard many times throughout the day from many people, cathartic. If there was any cynicism anywhere, I didn't see it. Coming away from it, I felt as though the company shrank a little. I met new people, got completely new points of view, and learned what other departments struggle with and succeed with. I don't know if a metric exists to measure the impact of Notes Day, but from where I was standing, it was huge. In the end, I think we all walked away with a sense of ownership over this amazing place and its future, a we're all in this together feel. If nothing else, this is a huge victory. John's openness and courage to speak about his feedback set an unbelievable bar. His admission put the entire company firmly behind him and was one of the finest instances of leading by example I can think of. I think we can all learn from that and accept our own introspection / feedback with a similar grace and humility. Thank you so much for creating an environment where this kind of discussion can happen. You'll remember that the exit forms filled out by Notes Day participants weren't